accession number 30392-3.
The flying train that you had volunteered for?
Oh, yes, I've more than volunteered, pestered for. And, yes, I did my flying training, elementary flying training on tiger moths in Canada, and then converted to, oh, God, those noisy American Harvards, also in Canada, back to the UK, down to, not Yeovil, Henstridge was the Spitfire training airfield in Somerset, and did my Spitfire training there.
How readily did you take to flying?
How?
How readily did you take to the flying?
Ah. I'm clumsy. I enjoy flying hugely. In some ways, I'm very good at it, or was very good at it, in the fact that I knew what was going on, etc., etc. But I was never the delicate touch, hands-on pilot. Ah, no. Oh dear, I should have bought my flying logbook. Having done my Spitfire conversion course, I then had to go and learn deck landings. So we went up to an airfield in Scotland, whose name I forget now, where we did aerodrome dummy deck landings, you know, batsmen batting you in and so on. And then, when we were thought to be good enough, we were sent off to do landings aboard a carrier in the Clyde. I'm not sure of the exact sequence of events. First or second attempt at deck landing, was it? Or third attempt? I was coming in, and I was low and slow. So the batsman waved me round again, saying, round again, round again. And when you have to go round again, if you're low and slow, the first thing you have to do is open the throttle wide and pull back on the stick to climb away. But what I didn't allow for was that there's 1/8 of a second of time as the throttle goes forward before the engine catches up, and I did both together. So, stall, straight in the drink. I got out without even getting my head wet. Stepped out onto the wing, and the destroyer, attendant destroyer, picked me up. And I was put back aboard the carrier and slept there overnight. And I think I've got this right. I think next morning they said, oh, all right then, come on, let's go on with this. And on my second or third attempt, another deck landings, I ran into the barrier. So they said, you go back ashore and do some more deck landing training, quite rightly. And again, I went back, did deck landing training, came back and did the deck landings on the carrier and got away with it. But you see, I'm not the delicate touch pilot. There were people who could take a Spitfire at treetop height and roll it like that. So I thought, well, I wonder. And I used to find stratus clouds way up in the sky, absolutely dead flat surface, and you go along and try and roll over this. And two or three times, yes, I'd do it, and the third or fourth time, I'd dip into the cloud. So I thought, no, I'm never going to do it at ground level.
What happened to the plane that you'd...
What
happened to the plane that you'd landed in the water?
It's still sitting down on the bottom of the Clyde, I suppose. I'm afraid. A lot of money there.
Going back to the initial flying training, what were the tiger moths like to fly?
Oh, a joy. I mean, fun. I mean, good thing to learn on for your... Yeah, they were, you know, very light and delicate. A couple of years ago, for my 80th birthday, my daughter's gave me a birthday present of a tiger moth flight out of an aerodrome down in Kent. And the weather had been awful. There was a great wind blowing and everything. So I phoned up to the airfield and said, "You're still doing these flights?" They said, "Oh, yes, we think so." I went off and I did this flight, and the weather, I couldn't hold the bloody aircraft still. It was bouncing all over the place. I'm sure when I did my flying training in Canada and the air was smoother, it was easier. No.
Was there a particular process through which one would start having not flown at all and then finish flying solo?
Sorry?
Was there a particular series of stages that would be put through?
Yes, I mean, you did, with a co-pilot, dual instruction for about 10 or 12 hours first before you were allowed to go solo. And then you had to learn, you know, landing techniques fairly regularly. I mean, to really get used to the plane. And then you were told to go and do some aerobatics and so on. Again, you probably do some aerobatics dual control with an instructor, and then you'd let off to go and do them solo. I wish I brought my flying... I thought about bringing my flying logbook, but then I thought, well, that's after the war. That's not right. And then, you know, we went on to noisy Harvards, where you went through the same process. You did probably not so much a 10 or 12 hours dual once you, you know, as you were on, you know, acclimatized to Harvards. And then, as I say, you know, down to Suffolk, down to Henstridge Airfield, and onto Spitfires.
How did you find them to fly?
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I fancy being paid to fly Spitfires. I remember the first time I took off, there's so much power there. I think I got up to about 2,000 feet before I pulled the undercarriage up. But they were great, but also dangerous. I mean, I did the flying training, Spitfire conversion course, and then I went on to do a photographic reconnaissance course on Spitfires. And you had an oblique camera on the port side under there, and you would take photographs and so on. And amongst other things, we did a lot of low flying all over the West Country and as far as Sussex in, you know, treetop height. Wonderful, exhilarating experience. And I remember once, too, wickedly awful. I think you better switch it off, actually, or I should get court-martialed. Flew down to, from Henstridge, I suppose it was, to King, oh God, down into Devon, where my mother had a house and two small children, and I had two mates with me, three Spitfires, and we beat up this house. Had my mother out in the garden saying, "Go away, go away." No, they were wonderful. But also, I said, we did a lot of flying training, low flying training, because of all, you know, reconnaissance work. And there was one trainee pilot, Pete Stevens, who was low flying, and the instructor thought he wasn't low enough and tried to fly underneath him and hit him, and the remains of the two aircraft were scattered over half a mile of fields. And I remember they saying, "Oh, the funeral." Well, we found 1 foot of Pete Stevens in a shoe, and we buried that. That is perhaps just an apocryphal story, but you know, there was not much left.
During your time in Canada, how much did you see of the Canadian wartime life and the population in Canada?
We mixed socially. I mean, we had time off. Of course we did. I forget how far from, of course, Ottawa, was it? Somewhere where there was a big city. And I went to the theatre there to see Paul Robeson play Othello with José Ferrer Iago and Uta Hagen as Desdemona. we mixed quite a bit, and they seemed very supportive of us, very, you know. And they were, but you know, it was a free, open country. There was no rationing like there was back in England and so on. And they were not being blackouts at night. They were just normal civilization.
How much had you been able to stay in contact with your parents throughout the war?
My parents?
Were they still in Uganda?
No. Must have been end of March 1940. My mother, with two young children, a daughter aged about 5 and a son aged about 3, or even a bit younger perhaps, set off down the Nile in a boat to Alexandria, caught a boat from Alexandria to Marseille, travelled by train from Marseille through to Calais, and caught the last boat out of Calais before the Germans captured Calais to get to England. They just made it. My father was still in Uganda, but he came home somehow a few, little bit later and joined the Navy's Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve officer, worked for Naval Intelligence, and did a lot of the diving off the Normandy coast to destroy German underwater mines and things like that, and underwater defences. He got into the Navy, finally. Having pushed me into the Navy, he got in eventually in the end. And, you know, they were both from... I forget where, how and when he got back to the UK, but he obviously must have been by sea.
What is the discipline in Canada more relaxed than you've been used to?
No, I don't think so. Not in the naval training, flying schools. I mean, on my service flying training course, I was a lieutenant by then, and I was the sort of the senior officer on the course. There was a sub-lieutenant. Oh, that's come off. There was a sub-lieutenant, Dan McKinnon. There was another lieutenant, Cook, and there were two or three volunteer reserve sub-lieutenants, I think, and 15 or 20 newly brought in seamen who were, you know, if they've completed their flying training satisfactorily, would then be promoted, because I think all naval pilots were promoted because, you know, living aboard a carrier, you really need, if you're going to be flying and alert and so on, you need a reasonable degree of comfort. A cabin to sleep in as opposed to a hammock amongst 30 other people. And that was made up the course, and, you know, I suppose we kept quite an eye on each other, especially the us officers.
What was your reaction to the end of the war?
Joy, I mean, great. Thank God we got, you know, defeated the Germans and the Japs and Nazism and Japanese. I can never, never understand why the Japanese did Pearl Harbor. What on earth did they expect to achieve? They were never going to occupy the States, were they? And, you know, anyhow, no relief. I might say that on VJ Day, I happened to be the officer of the day at Henstridge, and when Up Spirits came up at 11 o'clock, the regulating petty officer and I said, well, we're not going to, because anything surplus rum was always thrown away. Well, that day, VJ Day, we didn't throw it away. We drank it, the regulating petty officer and I. And naval rum is quite powerful stuff. And I remember it went to my kidneys. Oh, dear. And then trying to step up the next day onto the root of an air wing root of a Spitfire. Oh, agony. Mm-hmm. No, relief that the war was over. And exultation that we'd won, sort of thing.
Was there any degree of frustration that you wouldn't then be able to use in anger all the flying bit just been training for?
No, I don't remember. I'm sure not. I mean, I was still going to go on flying Spitfires. That was the thing. And as I say, I'd had experience of the horrors of war, and so it was good that it was over.
How then did your post-war flying?
I went to 804 Squadron was the first. Oh, no. I was, because the Japs had surrendered, but all, you know, the British Pacific Fleet was still in place, and I was flown out to Sydney and joined a Spitfire squadron out there in Australia, whose name, number I can't remember, and we patrolled around there and patrolled, not as far north as Japan, I don't think, but all around the Pacific Islands and New Zealand and the British Pacific Islands and so on, flying there just to impress the natives that we were there and they were protected and so on. And my mate Dan McKinnon, who I'd been doing flying training with, he'd been sent to the, not to Henstridge to do Spitfire training, but to Yeovilton to fly American aircraft, and he converted onto American Corsairs. And this is after the war, and he was coming in to land on the carrier one day, and his engine failed. So he undid his straps to bail out, looked over the side and saw, oh God, I'm too low to bail out, I'll have to ditch. And he ditched it and he couldn't do up his straps again. So when he hit the water, straight into the gun sight, smashed his face in, blinded in both eyes. The destroyer picked him up. They rushed him into Hong Kong Naval Hospital there. And he survived. They got him together again. And when he was in a reasonably fit state some months later, they appointed a fellow shipmate of his to go with him and put him on a boat to go back to the UK. Developed meningitis, put ashore in Singapore and died. And I think it was probably a merciful release. Completely, you know. So, and after that squadron in the Pacific, I was sent home again by sea. And eventually joined 804 Squadron, which was already in existence in Northern Ireland. And then again we went aboard a carrier, HMS Ocean, and we went out to the Indian Ocean and Australia and New Zealand. When we were in Australia, one Sunday, we had a lot of senior Australian officers and Admiralty Board and civilians come aboard, and we put on a flying display for them to show how carriers worked, to try and convince them that they should have a carrier of their own. Went out to sea with them, and we killed 7 people that day, I think it was. 2 fireflies collided in the landing circuit. That was 4 dead. One of our Spitfires landed and bounced over the barrier, and his wingtip cut off the head of somebody in the side watching. That was 5. And there were 2 more. I forget how they were. The Australians were not impressed. I don't know if they ever got themselves a carrier. Probably not. Oh yes, I landed ashore too, because my hook wouldn't fall down. My hook had jammed up, so I had to go and land ashore.
How did the carriers you were operating from function in terms of aircraft storage and lifts and hangars?
Well, this ocean, I forget what they call that class now. It has a lift up forward and a lift aft, and the barrier was somewhere in between, so that, you know, anybody who failed to pick up a hook, pick up a wire where this hook went into the barrier. You know all these things. As I say, it took a great deal of organization. And the Spitfires we had then, when I was on ocean, had power folding wings, so that when you landed, picked up a hook, came to a halt, they dropped the barrier, you taxied forward over the barrier, folded your wings, waited for the lift to be up, taxied onto the lift, were then lowered down. I think you could get 2 Spitfires on the lift at a time, or was it 1? 2, I think. And down, and then you'd be pushed off into the hangar, lift would come up, wait for the next landings to come in, and so on. And there were quite a lot of aircraft, obviously, parked up forward, waiting for the lift. I think that's how one of the people were killed in Australia, is that somebody taxied into them on the flight deck up there. I'm not sure. And similarly, when you were organising people to take up setting up the squadron for a takeoff, they'd all be pushed down to the after lift, hoisted up in the lift, pushed aft after the lift, lift bring up 2 more, and so on. And you'd all form up when you got up at the lift, then spread your wings, somebody would check and make sure they were locked. All right, a little incident. Entirely irrelevant. I forget where this was. Somewhere. I think we were in the Mediterranean then. And a camera crew came on board to make a safety documentary about how to avoid accidents. And there were various things that are liable to happen. And they were making this documentary to show to people, say, you know. And one way that accidents sometimes happen, and I know of one that happened, I was there once, when you take off in a Spitfire, as soon as you're airborne, you jink hard to starboard like that to clear the runway so that your slipstream is not going to affect the aircraft before behind you. And you do a steep pull off, and if you're not very careful, you can, you know, in that steep pull-off, stall and go down into the sea. And I remember that happening once on a carrier that I was in. Must have been that first appointment in Australia. There was one of the pilots, and his young brother was also a sub-lieutenant in the carrier, assistant to something or other, attached to the aviation part of it all. And this elder brother did have exactly that accident and killed himself. So, anyhow, this is an accident to be avoided. So I was briefed by the camera crew. The squadron leader will take off first. You come off second. And when you go off, take a deep, do your jink to starboard, and then dive below the level of the flight deck so everybody will think you've gone in the sea. So, right. Off we go. Squadron leader takes off. Squadron commander takes off. I follow him. I do a great big heavy jink to starboard. Oh, Jesus. The stick is absolutely soggy. I don't have to dive below the level. I fall below the level of the flight deck. And I just pulled away over the sea. So, right. It was very good for the camera crew. I went off and we did the exercises. When I landed and got out of the aircraft, I had a vital message. You go see the commander air immediately. And I had the biggest bollocking I've ever had in the Navy for endangering things unnecessarily or too much.
Was there any assistance for the carrier takeoffs for the aircraft?
Oh, yes, you could do a rock, catapult takeoff. Oh, yes, that was great. Wonderful. They were always up for it on the port bow. There was a steam-operated catapult. You'd sit at the back of the frame. The aircraft sit at the back of the frame, be connected up, I forget quite how and where, into this catapult. And you'd then watch the man there waiting who'd tell you to rev up. You'd dive right back in your seat, rev up the full power, and they'd fire the catapult, and whoosh! You'd go from 0 to 80 knots in about 200 yards, less. Wonderful sensation. And I remember, yes, also, in that first appointment in Australia, just after the end of the war, there were a lot of, I suppose they were American aircraft that we had aboard this, I think it was the Indefatigable, a big fleet carrier, that were now surplus, and the Americans didn't want them back. So what did we do to get rid of them? We catapulted half a dozen of them off into the sea. Astonishing. But I forget what they were. They were twin-seater. I forget what they were now.
Was there any sense of separation between the air crew and the ship's crew?
Yes.
Or the carrier?
There is an old, not a joke, but an apocryphal saying that if ever anybody concerned with aviation was in sort of any asked to do anything, not me, Chief, I'm Fleet Air Arm. I don't know. I don't know how other people viewed us. I don't think so, really. But as I say, there was a slight, not me, Chief, I'm Fleet Air Arm. I don't have to do that. And we didn't do normal watch keeping, or did we? I forget. I guess no. On occasions, I think we did. No, we didn't. No.
But did, having served as a midshipman before, give you a different perspective on things, perhaps?
Yes, perhaps so. I remember, yes, when we were in Sydney, this must have been in a big fleet carrier, must have been the Indefatigable. They organised a dinghy sailing race around Sydney Harbour. Because, you know, all the ships carried two or three dinghies, and for a big fleet air arm carrier, we certainly had three, if not four, 12-foot dinghies, I think they were. And we were going to have a regatta around Sydney Harbour. And yes, lovely, great fun. So I volunteered, and I was given one of the dinghies to sail, and I won the bloody race. the other day people couldn't really believe that a fleet air arm pilot, oh my God, he's sailing and winning the regatta. No.